All right, hello everyone. Welcome to the first session of the Football Scholars Forum for the 2014-2015 season. It's a real pleasure to welcome historian Roger Kittleson of Williams College, the author of The Country of Football, Soccer, and the Making of Modern Brazil. And as is customary, we'll let Roger say a few things for the first few minutes, and then we'll open up the floor for questions. Please, if you have a pressing question or just want to get into the queue, use the IM function in Skype, okay, the chat function. Thank you, and welcome, Roger.
Thank you so much, and thank you especially, Peter and Alex, for putting all this together. This is a wonderful, if you know, somewhat weirdly wonderful kind of event. Because we're all together and yet obviously so physically distant from each other. But this is, it's a great opportunity to, you know, hear from a lot of people whose work I know, who I know from their online presences as well. And I want to just start by talking a little bit about how I came to do this book. You know, as I actually talk about in the intro of the book, I have a long family history with Brazil, and since it's there, I don't need to go over that now. I'm also a longtime fan of Brazilian futebol, not only the national team, but of specific clubs as well. But, you know, as a historian, I didn't really consider soccer as a serious topic, even when I was, at Wisconsin and doing my PhD work. I really felt that I needed some, you know, something that was going to be more widely accepted as a serious kind of thing. So I did this dissertation that became a book about the politics of everyday life in the 19th century. While I was doing that, however, I was living in Brazil, first in Rio and then in Porto Alegre, and it just, you know, became ever more apparent to me that soccer was something I needed to talk about. I needed to study, in fact, in order to Brazil, to understand Brazil. And I don't mean that in the sort of Jacques Barzun way, you know, in his famous essay about baseball, where he attributes all sorts of essential meanings to the American national pastime. But I mean that in the way that, you know, there's something specific about the game in Brazil, and the way that Brazilians work through a lot of very tricky issues as they talk about soccer and as they use not just references to soccer, but the language from soccer in other realms of life. I started working on soccer before my first book actually came out in 2005. So it was before Brazil got the World Cup. So my opportunism is not quite as blatant as it might seem. And I was working on a much narrower, more social historical kind of topic, looking at club identities, fan culture club identities in São Paulo from the 1950s to the 1970s, which is something I was interested in, particularly because I wanted to understand violence and masculinity as well as race. I wanted to maintain a regional focus. My first book was on Porto Alegre way in the south. I moved up a little bit, but still wanted to maintain this regional focus. And I was working on this, but kind of losing a little bit of momentum. And then after I gave a talk at UMass Amherst, I was contacted by several scholars who were putting together this new sports history series for the University of California. Chris Young, Bob Edelman, Wayne Wilson, and Susan Brunel. And they basically just said that they needed someone to do a book about Brazilian soccer. And they thought I could be the person and asked if I would put something together. So I quickly wrote the nation-wide kind of book that I had not been planning. Did the first chapter, and you know, it's just sheer luck, along with that little bit of work I put in there that got me into the University of California series, which was wonderful. And they were an incredible team to work with, because it never seemed like I was dealing with four separate editors. They really kind of got themselves together and before ever communicating back with me, and did it really effectively and in a way, in ways that, that helped me. They also pushed me chronologically. They pushed me back much farther than I had intended to go, which is why I go back to the late 19th century. And that was the hardest part for me, because it's just a, you know, I'm a Brazilianist historian, and there's just so many huge issues that I had to suddenly work through. And they pushed me to come up to 2013. That part was also a little odd, because it's the kind of, you know, more presentist orientation that my students, of course, have always wanted. But I try to, you know, dissuade them from, you know, indulging them too much in. So it was a little bit of a stretch both ways. In the end, I really enjoyed this, and made the decision that this, you know, looking at this grand sweep, the long 20th century, was a great opportunity for me to take on major questions in Brazilian history in this period. And, you know, not to try some sneaky way to do it, but to go really in the after the most obvious and even most canonical figures, and some of the, as you know, to get to these major themes. I really wanted to deal with modernity and how that changed over time, how the debates over what kind of modernity Brazil should be attempting, how those changed from period to period. And within that, how race, region, and nation were continually redefined and struggled over. I was somewhat disappointed in that the masculinity side of the question basically fell out of my analysis. It's there kind of lurking, but it's certainly not foregrounded. That is something I'm taking up now in a follow-up project. But I really wanted to look at this question of how Brazilians develop the sense of their uniqueness, their exceptionalism, and how they understood this, in part by using signifiers from the world of futebol. So that's my introduction, since you all have read my book's introduction. But I'm excited to hear your comments and questions and get our talk going.
Great, thank you. Somebody's in the queue, but my goodness, I can't figure out who that is.
I'm in the queue. It's Brenda, I think. Is that, or am I stepping on toes? Oh, Alex texted.
Tell you.
Yes, okay.
Hey, go, Brenda.
Okay, I have many questions, but I'm going to limit myself because I'm sure other people will want to too. Thank you, Roger. I enjoyed the book enormously. I do have a question about what else is lurking here.
Yes.
I felt like, and I'm, this is a constructive question about choices, because we all have to make choices in the book, and you have such a lot of material to work with that you more than even many other historians of football have to make many, many choices. So my question is, for me, when I read this, I feel like the question of class and the construction of class really ends up taking a back seat in your larger arc, but yet in your stories, in the smaller narrative sort of biopics that you have here, it's always so present. And so I wanted to ask you, from a, you know, sort of salacious reader question, do you think then ultimately this is a story of how futebol convinces Brazilians that class is not as important as a social identity? Or, I don't know. This is my question for you.
Yeah, that doesn't even come close to being salacious. you can do better, Brenda. Come on.
You don't know how excited I am about this question.
No, that's a great point, because obviously there are, as you say, that, you know, we all have to make these choices about, you know, what we can do and what we wish we could do, the things that we, you know, can't avoid and the things that we are happy to avoid. Class is certainly one of the things I essentially avoid, and you know, in the center of my analysis, I think you're right that it's there. It is something that I struggled a lot with, and partly again because one of the things that I'm dealing with is you know, how there's really a struggle over national identities. And, you know, coming from, you know, from my coming up from the South, basically, from Porto Alegre and then to São Paulo, you know, I've always had this sense of, you know, these national histories really being histories of the, you know, the victory of the center South in Brazil, of, you know, Rio and São Paulo. You know, they're not acknowledged as that, you know, that kind of victory goes unsaid. So I wanted that. That's one of the other things that I wanted to kind of bring in, but, you know, and I wrote a lot of the manuscript was, over twice as long as, what you all, have slogged through. But, classes is another thing that I couldn't find a way to think to present it in a nationwide kind of, scope in a way, you know, without really going region by region, because it works so differently in different regions. So mostly I did leave it as in these little stories, which my students, who Brenda met when she graciously came to talk to them in a history and theory class that I teach. You know, I confessed to them that in writing this book, my one of my mantras was, history is the story of people, which is, you know, compared to what I was teaching them, it just didn't make sense to them and seemed highly, you know, laughable that I would adopt that when I was, you know, pushing them through Foucault and things. But class is something that, you know, again, I'm trying to do a new project on Corinthian, the working class club in São Paulo, the second biggest club in Brazil, has a very strong, kind of hyper masculine kind of, fan culture, very working class, famously not very interested in the beautiful part of the beautiful game. And I'm trying to get at that in this smaller way, but in the bigger project, I honestly did my best, but couldn't come up with a way that seemed convincing without being cumbersome.
Thank you, Roger. That was a very thorough and satisfying answer.
/ evasion, but yes.
Danielle, you're in the queue next. Go ahead.
Hi, Roger. This is Daniel.
Yes.
Since I'm German, I need to ask a question on this year's semifinal. is this for you comparable with the tragedy of 1950 that you describe in the introduction? And what's the message that this year's World Cup sent to the world on Brazil's stage of development?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Danielle. By the way, it's great to hear that you're not far away. I hope to run into you in Cambridge.
That would be great.
Yes, we'll figure that out. It was after the 7-1 defeat to Germany. There was a lot of talk, and to this day, there's still every now and then someone will say, well, this is another Maracanazo, and it's going to be this kind of national trauma. But honestly, it wasn't, for a lot of reasons. First of all, you know, Brazil has a lot of other things going on. They have a presidential election coming up that is very much in everyone's mind, and that is taking up most of the media space these days. Soccer is simply not as exclusively important. And it was never exclusive, you know, the only thing that mattered, even in the sports world, but certainly not in the kind of racialized national cultural world. But I think it's lost a bit in that realm. So it just doesn't matter. And in fact, what as much as it did, and you know, one of the things that I think the defeat meant to Brazilians. Kind of reinforced their sense of the people in power just being thoroughly corrupt and less concerned with, I mean, really solely concerned with their own gain, not concerned with, you know, leading Brazil in any, you know, meaningful way on the international stage. I think to other, you all, others of you can speak, you know, better than I about how it was perceived outside of Brazil. I think there is still some pride in Brazil that in spite of everything, in spite of, not in spite of the protest, but in spite of the horrendous violence that was used by the police to squash the protests, there still were protests, of course, but, you know, a lot of them were shut down, and a lot of people I talked to said that, yeah, they just stopped going to the streets because it was just too, police were too violent and too scary. In spite of that, you know, Brazil still did put on a World Cup that, you know, was by and large a pretty successful thing. And a lot of the other, you know, the resentment of officials and politicians is also tied up with you know, this, the worldwide demonization of FIFA, which I am all in favor of, may I say. And so, you know, it in some ways, the obvious corruption and scheming and manipulation that FIFA's been, and profiteering that FIFA's, you know, been exercising so vigorously, that's really almost distracted a lot of attention from things in Brazil.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Dania.
Okay, we'll make the next couple of comments and questions here in East Lansing. Lubia.
So as a Brazilian, I have something to say about this event, the 7-1. This World Cup this year, because it's very funny, because sometimes I think football, Brazilian football national team is more important to outside market. Mm-hmm. It's not to the people in Brazil who loves football as well.
Yeah.
Many people, they were disappointed, but they are more attached to the regional teams and the national league. And so it's, for me, it's not a big problem. The trauma, for sure, it was related to last year events, the protests as well. But it was good to deconstruct this myth about all Brazilians love football and support football as the same kind of the market.
Yeah.
As we say, Cartolas there, the big man behind football.
Yeah.
They are the best ones to talk about Brazilian football in foreign country, not in the country.
No, you're right. Within Brazil, there's much more concern and, you know, anger about, you know, the way that, you know, in São Paulo, the way that Palmeiras is being run on its centennial year, it's, you know, looking like it's going to definitely be relegated. And, you know, my team in Rio Botafogo is not really, it, you know, doesn't really pay its players, which is a problem, you know. I think more of, I think you're right. And partly that's because of the way that the national team, I mean, partly that was just simply always true, that local mm-hmm. clubs, and, you know, regional competitions, the state competitions, which do seem ludicrous from outside, you know, but they mean a lot, you know, within the different parts of Brazil. You know,
I was thinking in a political perspective as well, because many people, they say that the players who are invited to be part of the national team, they go to make money in Euro. So it's a kind of betray to the country to go to play in a rich country. And not support the local national teams in Brazil. So it was a kind of revenge in this way. And the other thing is maybe it's the 1970 World Cup during the dictatorship that was used in a very political way to repress protests against dictatorship. So this 2004 World Cup defeat was good for people who were there from that time when the government took football as a kind of political coin to repress.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's an important point, is that, you know, the World Cup, I mean, Brazil has certainly lost a lot of times since 1970 and played a lot worse than they did this time even. But having it in Brazil and making Brazil this world stage did allow exactly the kinds of things that were, you know, violently prohibited in 1970. That is to say, you know, a real lively public sphere with lots of, you know, open dissent and you know, these marches and things on all sorts of different causes. You know, friends, I you know, talked to friends who kind of went out to the streets in Rio and São Paulo for all sorts of different reasons, including my uncle, you know, he's in his 80s, who he's actually kind of right wing, but he joined with all these left wing neighbors because he was protesting against the corruption of the PT, whereas they were protesting against, you know, the police violence, you know. But it was still, what was, you know, was so amazing was that, you know, it was just incredible public sphere, and you know, where all sorts of protests could be made, more in 2013 obviously than in 2014, and yeah, so I think 1970 was there as an interesting kind of, you know, historical counterpoint. I think that's an important point. Yeah.
I have a comment and a question, Roger. I thoroughly enjoyed the book. I particularly appreciated the Portuguese language sources and the massive bibliography. I think this is really what distinguishes what we do as scholars versus what journalists do. It really sparks new ideas and can potentially launch new projects in the future. And it's just wonderful. I'll be teaching this book in my global soccer courses without a doubt. It's clear that we've come a long way since Janet Lever's Soccer Madness, and even Tony Mason's Passion of the People, which was almost entirely based on English language sources, as good as it was. My question really comes from being an Africanist who has studied the social history of football quite a bit, and I was intrigued by your use of tropical modernity as a concept. Obviously very key to the book because it brings race and nation together in clear ways. Is modernity still big in Brazilian studies? And if so, what do you mean by it? Because there were several I just wondered, you know, is this a kind of heuristic thing? Is this a hook? Are we talking about urbanization? Are we talking about something very specific, or is this something that at times is sort of intentionally a bit more abstract than you want? And also, you know, is this something that politicians and a few journalists are using? So is it coming out of your sources? Or are people really in Brazil, especially people who are crazy about futebol, really referencing modernity? Because I would have liked to have seen a little more evidence. For example, you know, talking about the stadiums and how people experience the stadiums, the torcedeiros, or, you know, something about that fan culture you were talking about earlier in our, your introductory remarks. So can you talk a little bit about that and maybe flesh out a little bit more, if you'd like, you know, how this tropical modernity is changing at particular times and why? Because I don't know if I got all of those changes and what was driving them.
Yeah, well, it is something that comes out of the sources, not the phrase tropical modernity, but certainly an interest in modernization. And yeah, it's always a fraught term. It's something that's talked about, you know, throughout this whole long period that I study and you know, given different and competing definitions in each part of that big sweep of time. It is also something that does show up, you know, in all of these sources that I have, and I read today still, you know, the several Brazilian newspapers I read every day online, you know, there's still a lot of, you know, in discussions about futebol, there's still a lot of discussion about how, you know, Brazil needs to modernize its soccer and what kind of that, you know, what kind of broader national modernization that would, you know, be part of or would reflect. It's phrased in different ways by different people. So it's always there in the sources. It's less clear that it's a daily presence in fan culture. It is certainly in fan culture, but it is it's a little less central. That is, you know, again, that's something that I, you know, opted to, you know, push to the background and to a large extent kind of push out of the book, simply because I was talking about, you know, national level discourses and then, you know, getting into as much detail about the different debates, you know, between cities, between different actors within cities, at different points. So, you know, just to, you know, take some, a couple of, you know, one key moment, you know, the 30s. This is a period. The other major thing that gets cut from my manuscript is a sort of political and sociocultural analysis of the different periods that is as long as the book that you have. So I wrote a lot more, as we all do, than I ended up with, and it's a good thing that I cut it, but it hurt. But you know, to just take the 30s, you know, this is a, you know, Brazil is coming out of a major regime change in 1930, the so-called revolution of 1930, and they're beginning in the early 20s. There were these, you know, various kinds of moves to integrate and even centralize the country in different ways. Some of them, you know, fascist inspired, but not all of them by any means. And they have ideas about modernizing the nation to, you know, bring it in line, making an economic power, make a more logical, rational use of the physical and social resources. This is precisely when people like Lins Hugo and Gilberto Freire and Mario Filho start talking about mulatto futebol. And, you know, there's a government in place that's sliding into a dictatorship, trying to become a police state, really, that's only too eager to pick up on that as a useful tool to unify this populace behind. And a lot of what I talk about is how how this implies some tensions that never really go away, because it involves integrating and also making the povo, the common folk of Brazil, the foundation for progress. And, you know, that's, you know, what exactly that progress means, that's never absolutely agreed on. It's always, you know, this hegemonic process of you know, it's facing lots of challenges. But, you know, just having the povo in there means that, you know, this part, this huge part of the population that has been seen as primitive is now being identified as essential to modernity. And so there are just contradictions there that, you know, won't go away and don't go away. And in some ways are still with us today. But yeah, tropical modernity is a term that I use to try to capture that sense of, and part of what I wanted to get at, you know, one of the big themes I wanted to get is this very simple notion that Brazilian Brazilianness has always incorporated this kind of wild patriotism, this ufanismo, but also this really cynical sense of how Brazil will never reach, you know, the great future that the country of the future should have.
Great, thank you. Javier Pescador, next question.
Oh, yeah, hi, Roger, hi, everybody. My question has to do with the comments by Brenda and Nuria. I really like them, and I have two anecdotes that are related to the question that I'd like you to answer. One is that when I was in South China this past World Cup, I watched the 7-1 Germany victory over Brazil, and it was like 4 a.m. in Quanzhou, in this city in South China, and the bars were crowded, and everybody was either cheering for Germany or for Brazil, but there was no Brazilians in the street. And the second observation that comes to my mind is when I used to play in the Michigan Soccer League for a team named Brazil that had a sponsorship and traveling money and a lot of perks, but nobody in the team, nobody was from Brazil. And my question is, to what extent or what is your opinion on this process of brandification of the Brazilian national image that is more for a corporate, you know, sponsorship in global terms and also a international consumption. This sort of a Brazilianness that is more for exportation purposes. So I like to know what is your opinion, what is your take on this process, because I am writing on a similar process that is affecting the Mexican national team.
Oh, yeah.
That is followed by Mexican fans in the United States more than by Mexican fans in Mexico, and has played since the 1980s more games in the U.S. as a local team than in Mexico itself. So I wonder what is your take in this process of brandification or globalization of the Brazilian national image that is now for corporate sponsorship and international consumerism.
Yeah, well, thank you. That's a great question, and it's great to talk to you. I've taught some of your articles in my classes, and your new project sounds fascinating. This Mexico probably does have an easier time and gets less criticism when it plays in the U.S. than when it plays in Mexico. So, I mean, I can't wait to see what you have to say about that. In any case, that's something that's been going on, you know, and it's been going on for so long that, of course, lots of people make fun of it. And, you know, in England, they say, you know, if somebody makes a, you know, if an English player or a Welsh player does something great, you know, but it's sort of forgotten, they say, well, you know, if a Brazilian had done that, we'd still be talking about it. And Brazil, you know, still has now this Gillette World Tour. It's Brazil. It's not the best team in the world. It's not, you know, Brazil's not even close to being the best team in the world. But, you know, it's not Germany that gets that kind of tour. It's not Argentina. It's Brazil. And, again, it is because of that image that gets created, you know, in large part referring back to the golden age, the, you know, the 1958-62, but especially the 1970 World Cup. And it's something that, you know, in the book I try to get at how this is just takes off, you know, like a rocket in the 90s, when, you know, Brazil's come out of a dictatorship, when it's, you know, especially from about 93-94 on, when this period of unbelievable inflation and economic turmoil and social violence seems to be calming down a little bit. Certainly, you know, under Fernando Henrique Cardoso, at least there's a little more stability eventually in the economy. But at the same time, both under Cardoso and then, you know, under Lula, the neoliberal economic development kind of plan, it's the one that's, you know, guiding Brazil to this day. There's a kind of social democratic element still, and I'm not making any electoral speeches here, by the way. I'm not I'm not pushing Dilma or Marina, but it's something that, you know, this neoliberal moment in that, you know, which really comes in the 90s in Brazil, is something that, you know, takes this you know, branding of Brazil and really, you know, firms it up. And when Brazil, you know, wins the 94 World Cup in, you know, really kind of pitiful way, it felt terrible for the Italians. Not that terrible, but, you know, pretty bad. That just, you know, part of me thought, oh, well, this is actually really bad for Brazil. It's great for Brazil that they won. It's terrible because still they're going to be able to get away with not really playing well. But being, you know, getting all the credit of still being the team that plays beautiful soccer when they haven't really played beautiful soccer since about 1982. It's something that happened before this neoliberal wave, but that, you know, really with it in the 90s, the profits and the vested interests in that just are overwhelming. And, you know, I did hope during the 7-1 defeat, which everyone seems to need to talk about, by the way, thank you very much. I did think, you know, first of all, I'm an Arsenal fan and I'm used to seeing my team lose in these horrible, you know, collapses. But I did think, well, maybe this will be so bad that there will actually be change. And there wasn't, and there won't be. You know, the CBF president, Marin, you know, he was the one who put this together, who brought in the coach, and he's got a really questionable, awful political record going back to his days as a senator under the dictatorship. And now, you know, he's gonna step down, but his name is on the CBF headquarters building in Rio, and the people who take over from him are gonna be really just more of the same. So I was hoping that there would be something that would, you know, push against that branding a little bit, but I'm not sure that there's enough pressure yet, anyway, to do so.
Okay, the next two questions from Ruani Sibaha and Andrew Guest. Ruani, go ahead.
Hey, Roger.
Hey, Ruani.
I was really excited to read the book, and I'm just thrilled to have had a chance to look at it. And, you know, of course, it was also kind of negative because I felt like now I'm writing the Argentine knockoff of your book. But one of the things that struck me is there's so many parallels between both countries, and particularly the Argentina in the 50s, when after they had their disastrous World Cup in 58, they were looking at what Brazil had done right. Mm. And some of the what came out in the press was about how the Brazilians were had employed a lot of the European tactics and organizations, had trained with the right balls that were going to be played in Sweden. And then, of course, Argentina makes its adjustment. So speaking of parallels, you talk about this fuchibol forza and fuchibol arte, this tension that comes out later. But do you see any of that coming in the 50s? Is it maybe labeled a different way? And I guess the bigger question is, you know, for both countries, a lot of this has to do with branding. You know, how do you want the outside world to see you through soccer?
Right. Right.
And so how much – speak more to, I guess, to the Brazilian case of like how much of Futebol Forza and Arte was about branding and to what was the – what were the goals of this sort of projection that they're trying to send to the world, to the outside world?
Yeah, the thing that's – there's about six excellent questions there. So I'll do what I can. And I look forward to your work too. Those tensions over the sort of the different what the national style was it, you know, this skillful way of playing that, you know, is based on these sort of intuitive primitive skills done in a dance like way with this jinga, the special rhythm and all this nonsense. You know, that's something that is created really, you know, beginning in the 30s, but isn't labeled as such. I mean, Gilberto Freire, you know, says the phrase Futebol Arte in the 40s sometime, but it's not a, you know, that doesn't really come out until the 70s, and it comes out almost immediately after 1970. And what's interesting, I mean, there are two really interesting things about that. One is that there is this move to change things almost immediately after Brazil wins its third World Cup, the 3 out of 4, you know, and takes home the Jules Rimet trophy to hold for all forever and ever, or at least until they let it be stolen out of the national headquarters in 1983. But so that's one thing that's interesting. And the other thing is that when you look back then, of course, it becomes less surprising because there are, in fact, tensions over the national style, even during the golden age. And this is some stuff that I didn't, you know, really fully develop in the book and have done more with since. But particularly when it comes to some of these, the planning that you were talking about, the careful planning, but also after the defeat in 1966, the incorporation of, what's for the time, pretty advanced sports medicine. There were Brazil had a fairly well-developed physical education system. You know, the army was a huge part of that going back to the 19th century, but there was a civilian side of it as well. And Brazilian researchers did a lot of work on altitude training and other things like that in the early 60s, trying to build up military teams, like the military pentathlon team, which won that international competition in the Netherlands in 1965, and it was a big deal. And at the time, that was hailed as a huge advance and was really a different kind of modernity. That, you know, this was, you know, these scientists were seen as, this was a kind of technological modernity, very top-down, scientifically based. And so in 1970, Brazil wins, and there are these kind of two different things that are not yet fully distinguished from one from the other. So there's, on the one hand, you know, this kind of growing, you know, worship of science and science applied psychology is a big part of this as well. You know, things that, you know, technologies that are imposed from above, and were quite successful. Absolutely, Brazil was one of the leaders in that. But on the other hand, you know, this sort of just the skills, that are seen as coming from the, you know, the Bolvo. And right after that, you know, at the height of the dictatorship, this is the Anos de Chumbo, the years of lead, the most, you know, when the dictatorship becomes most repressive, that's when the split comes. You know, these things are not fully developed as, you know, clearly alternative visions of modernity until after 1970, right after 1970. And it's right in that political context that the split becomes really apparent. And it is kind of more apparent than real in one sense, because a lot of the people who are pushing for Futebol Achi, people like João Saldanha, who is a newspaper man but also a coach. He coached Botafogo in the 50s. He was the coach who got Brazil qualified for 1970, but then he was fired before the World Cup. Anyway, you know, he comes out as one of the big champions of Futebol Achi. But, you know, he had also brought in the scientists and approved of their work and praised them for their work. However, what he opposed was the top-down kind of nature and the disdain that was implied in that approach toward the people and the, you know, the players who largely came from, you know, very poor classes. Oh, there's class again. Yes, I should really have dealt with that more. That's when that comes out, and it's a lot of it is just, you know, just political, if I can say just political. But it's a huge thing that really starts right after 1970. The coach Zagallo publishes a book called Lessons of the Cup in 1971, in which he says Brazil's got to reformulate everything. And what that means is, you know, forgetting about that Futebol Achi and going back to this other kind of modernity, the scientific modernity.
Which doesn't make a lot of sense if you just won the cup, but rather the 70 triumph almost seems like an aberration in this longer period from 66 on. Is that maybe a better way to look at it?
I think that is an excellent way to put it, to think about it, because you know, and in some ways it's an aberration. It's just sheer luck that they have the players. You know, they have this great, you know, safra, this great harvest of players. You know, 66, not so much. You know, Garrincha was could barely walk around anymore, and some of the other players who were star in 1970 were still young, Tostão and Carlos Alberto, and you know, they're still you know, too young to really lead. But they all kind of come together at the right time in 1970, and you know, the scientific training really did help them. Absolutely, the altitude training, they did in Rio and then in Mexico. And there's this great report that they did for FIFA, that Brazil did for FIFA about 1970, which they show a chart of the training schedule. And, you know, so they're all self-glorifying, you know, these are the trainers, Lamartine, Pereira da Costa and other guys. And in this chart, it's 19 weeks. The last 3.5 weeks are the World Cup. But it looks just like, it's like no different. There's like the training, we're doing this training for these weeks in Rio, then we're doing this other kind of training in Guanajuato and so forth. But you know, like the actual World Cup, it's just like part of this broader thing, and it doesn't get any special mention, because they had this, you know, vision of a broader, scientifically defined, athletic campaign. And the, you know, the games themselves were just a kind of detail.
Thanks.
Sure.
Andrew, to close out the first round or for first half.
First half. Oh my God.
Okay. I'm not a historian, so I hope I don't take us too far off track. I'm a little more sociologically inclined and had some of the same questions that have already been asked about the choices around sort of race versus class and things like that. But I thought instead I might try to ask a more sort of meta question back to your initial description of getting involved in the project and how the book came about. And it seems like the last couple World Cups, it feels to me like particularly with South Africa and Brazil, there were kind of a raft of books that came out around the World Cup trying to take at least somewhat of a scholarly perspective and use the World Cup as a vehicle for sort of educating and for engaging with some scholarly perspectives. And I love that. I mean, it's fun to see all those books when they come out, and I enjoyed your book as well. I'm curious sort of generally how it was for you to be part of that and how that leaves you thinking about it. Partially in I guess I'd maybe ask it in two parts. One is sort of in contrast to some of the other books. I somewhat reluctantly used the Dave Zirin Brazil's Dance with the Devil book this summer. Just I say somewhat reluctantly because it's so clearly a kind of activist agenda, and the history in it is a little bit it's obviously a somewhat sort of amateur history. And I'm curious generally how you think about all the other books, and then also just that broader, you know, just your experience with it going forward. I don't know what it's going to look like for Russia or for Qatar, if there's just going to keep multiplying the number of books that come out, the number of things that come out, but how you think that platform, how the whole experience leaves you thinking of the platform as an opportunity for scholarly perspectives and scholarly engagement, if that makes sense.
It does, and thank you. It's a great question. And I when I saw that David Goldblatt and Dave Zirin were both coming out with books, you know, part of me just like, oh shit, you know, because I like both of them so much, and admire the different things that they do, and like their books for that matter. But part of me, though, as I was just trying to explain this to someone down at Duke, and I was, you know, as exciting as it is to, you know, get people to read your book and connect it to, you know, sort of more contemporary things, and then, you know, use your book to kind of think about more contemporary things in a historical way, it was also slightly uncomfortable, because I had that sense that, you know, friends of mine who do like comparative politics, very contemporary things, you know, that they always have expressed to me, which is, well, this is great, but, you know, in 2 years, who's going to look at this? Because things are going to change, and there'll be Russia, and then, you know, maybe someone will go back and, you know, read about Brazil. Just, you know, like a couple people will go back as, you know, for the sake of comparison, but that's about it. And so that made me a little slightly uncomfortable, even though, you know, it also was great because more people read the book than would have done otherwise. And there was important stuff going on, and I was thrilled to be part of, you know, bringing in some of that stuff out, and especially the historical side of it out. I certainly hope that there will be even more written about Russia and Qatar, but I certainly think, you know, my guess is from the people I know who are Middle Easternists and Russianists, that it'll be a little tougher just in terms of you know, research possibilities and access to sources and that sort of thing. But I certainly hope that it, you know, will continue. You know, I'm also a grumpy old historian, so you know, I want people to be reading history and thinking about the historical things, not just in a presentist kind of way, which is not what I understand. That's not what you're pushing, but it's useful. But I don't want, you know, I don't want every one of my courses to be, you know, the history behind the headlines. That can be great. That can really be great. And one of the most useful things that students can get out of a class, but it shouldn't be the only thing. And I hope they come to look at history for other reasons. And I'm certainly going on to, you know, look not only at this sort of fan culture and around Corinthians in São Paulo, but also
trying to get my head around a bigger project on the emergence of Brazil as a racial signifier in transnational discussions of race. So that one is going to be probably bigger than I will be able to do in my remaining years on this earth, but I'll give it a shot.
All right. Thank you. And it's okay, Andrew. You can be a sociologist and be part of the Football Scholars Forum. We love everyone.
In Brazil, they say, you know, you could say sociologists are people too. It's okay, you know.
I'm an anthropologist.
We even have an anthropologist.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. We're
allowing everybody in.
Oh, goodness.
We're a big church.
So much promiscuity. It's great.
Full of communists and atheists, our church, or at least agnostics. The next question starts the second half. David Kilpatrick has a question and has not asked one, so let's go to him, and then Danielle, Brenda, and I will take the fourth one there, and the queue is still open for folks to join in. So let's pass the ball to David Kilpatrick in New Jersey, right?
No, New York. How dare you say it? Forget about it. I really enjoyed the project, and not just because we're both gooners. But my question is really about the lingering impact of the Maracanazo, but also more importantly, or more to the point, you talk a bit about the 1938 radio coverage. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit the way technology brings the nation together as such. And the way in which Brazil's sense of sporting identity has evolved with the evolution of different technologies and representations of the game.
Oh, that's a great couple of questions. I'll talk about the technology one first. 38 is something. The radio coverage is something that I hadn't really thought much about, hadn't really heard much about until I went and read memoirs and read newspaper accounts as well. And, people just talked about how, the narrator's voice was heard throughout the streets. And, you know, there were a lot of accounts, you know, many of them very obviously exaggerated about, you know, even the new immigrants are getting together with the people who've been there for a long time, and all differences are put aside and so forth. But it comes at an interesting point because, again, this is the Vargas government and this dictatorship called the New State, the Estado Novo. And the Vargas is trying to use radio and other technologies to promote a new unified national culture, not just with futebol. He was trying this with samba. He's trying with carnaval. Which were, successful in large part. And Brian McCann, a historian at Georgetown, writes about this beautifully in his book called Hello, Hello, Brazil, which is about radio and the propagation of new national forms of samba in the same period. But, soccer has this great other, feature, which is, it involves international competition. And so this whole question of, measuring, using some part of culture to measure progress against another nation's progress is there in a way that, it isn't there with samba. And it's happening at this, right at that time when there's this government push to, reach out. And radio, like TV later, is actually, much more widely and spread across Brazil than people might have expected. Because, obviously, you don't have to own your own radio or your own TV. You can watch your neighbor, listen to your neighbors or watch your neighbors. You might have to listen to it even if you don't want to, depending on how close and noisy your neighbors are. But certainly... first radio in the 30s and 40s, and then TV later on. I mean, one of the things that really sets apart the 1970 World Cup is that it's broadcast in color, which is a huge a huge deal for Brazilians, but for other people as well. And, you know, and that really does, I think, you know, just kind of add a bit of the possibilities of integration. But I don't want to, you know, overstate those. It also opens the way for possibilities of dispute, and those do happen. You know, not so much in the early 70s when the dictatorship is at its harshest, and censorship is at its strictest. But certainly by the late 70s and into the early 80s, there's some slippage. In this process known as, first known as relaxing the distinção, and then opening a abertura. So, yeah, I mean, the technology is able to, you know, contribute, to, you know, to not only integration, but also to the formulation of the two sides of the debate over the national style, futebol action versus futebol força. So... I'll just leave it at that. If you have other more specific questions about later, I'm happy to talk about that too.
Thanks.
Thank you.
If it's okay, Daniel and Brenda, Alejandro wants to jump the queue because it's related to the radio question. Is that okay?
Of course, yeah.
Brilliant. Alejandro, over to you.
No, thank you very much again. My name is Alejandro, and I also wanted to thank you for this book. I mean... It helped me to see more ways of how we talk about soccer. And I guess my question was to what extent I understood that you didn't follow radio too much, and why, if that's the case, why you didn't decide to follow radio as a source? And yeah, I mean, why you decided and what were the motives, I guess, to do it or to not? Because, I mean, I see that some biographies, you bring out how radio took place into this debate, in itself, I don't know if you actually pursue radio in itself. I mean, if you listen to some of the broadcasts.
That's a great question. It's the kind of thing that every time I would, you know, find myself in an archive listening to old radio shows. There are a couple of great archives in Rio, and one in Rio, one in São Paulo, that have old recordings. I would, you know, my head would just explode because I would think, okay, well, why am I doing, you know, a long century of history? Because I, you know, there's just so much. And plus I worked on the 19th century before. So even coming into the 20th century, my head was already, you know, aching from the flood of sources that I was finding. I didn't do more with radio simply because I didn't think I could do it justice all the way through the period that mattered. And I thought rather than doing a kind of, you know, incompetent job, I would merely mention it in, I guess, somewhat the same way I treated class, you know, allowing hints and waiting to read other people who can do more thorough and more careful and better job of that kind of thing, because it's certainly there. And it's, you know, the sources are there too. It's just, this is a project, you know, as I said, you know, I took a long time to do, you know, started 2004, 2005. But on the other hand, I also did it incredibly fast in the actual writing of the book as a book about, you know, as a national focused book, was about 2 years. And that for me is really fast. For David Goldblatt, I know that is like slow because he can write a beautiful book in, you know, in 6 months or something. But, the radio resources were, you know, sort of a whole nother layer of rich kind of material, that I honestly just, if I had gone into that, I wouldn't have finished the book.
Great, thank you. Let's pass it backwards from the midfield back to the defense, perhaps. Daniel and then Brenda.
Yeah, hi. How do you see the role of Pelé, or I should say Dr. Pelé, and his term as a minister of sports in Brazil and his societal impact?
Obviously he's there's so much about him. He's so important that it's hard to even know where to begin. I will say about his time as when he was in the cabinet. I mean, that was he was the first self-identified Afro-Brazilian in the cabinet. Not the first Afro-Brazilian to be in the cabinet, but the first who admitted that, you know, to being Afro-Brazilian. At the time, and in, when I was first really, you know, thinking analytically about his project that became the Le Pelé, I was actually very favorable to it, and you know, it seemed to be a way of, you know, doing away with this old system of the pass, you know, and which in Europe gets, you know, mostly done away with by the Bosman ruling. In practice, of course, what's happened in Brazil is that it hasn't really it hasn't benefited actual, you know, players, like living people, very much at all. It's benefited the few who have the kind of star power to, but they probably would have benefited anyway. For many, many more, what it's meant is that, you know, clubs had not put very much effort or, invested much energy or money into developing young players and really try to sell them off as quickly as they can before they're really fully matured as players and really probably, you know, most of them are not really ready, you know, even kind of emotionally, much less footballistically, to be playing in another country, in a place where, you know, they have to learn the language quickly. They're 17. They're torn away from their, you know, their social networks and so forth. In some ways, the Le Pelé, you know, it has been it started as a kind of liberatory project. But in fact, has really just been part of the neoliberalization and whatever his initial intentions were, and I think they were mixed, he certainly hasn't done much good for actual Brazilian players.
Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel.
Brenda.
Hi. I'm just really enjoying this. Another question I had to do with the chants that were directed toward Gilma. I was struck, you know, it caused quite a lot of commentary around the world, really, about the misogyny of Brazilian fans, and I wasn't so sure about that. My question was, did those chants build on a kind of repertoire of sexist chants that are pretty common in fan culture? Was this a deviation from things that are normal in Brazilian sort of political protest? I don't know. I was wondering how you situate them historically.
Yeah, well, as someone else referred to earlier, and this might have been in the sort of pregame chat that we had.
I missed it.
Yeah, no. But let me just say, it is. I mean, these are very much part of fan culture in a lot of clubs. My knowledge of the Portuguese language was expanded tremendously, but not always in very good and healthy ways, by attending, you know, I especially in Porto Alegre, in the clássico between Internacional, which is the good side, and Grêmio, which is obviously the evil team, the Tottenham of Brazil, let's say.
you know, just be the incredible sexist and homophobic language and chants. And so what was chanted, you know, toward her, at her, was horrible and violent. And but not all that surprising. I do think that any politician in her position would have been subject to, you know, hostility, with the possible exception of Lula. And I think he would have received some, but not as much. But the fact that she's a woman, you know, meant that it got expressed with a kind of greater, not just vehemence, but real violence than would have been expressed otherwise.
That's really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you.
That feeds nicely into a very short question that I had, which is, you know, one of my favorite chapters in the book is the one on Brand Brazil. And it was interesting to hear from you the extent to which you were uncomfortable writing about very contemporary history, because I thought you were extremely good at it. Maybe use this opportunity to tell us a little bit about how women in particular fit into the making of this Brand Brazil, or at least in the making of the nation. And I'm thinking, you know, for example, of Marta, what, 5 times player of the year, according to FIFA, and the success that the Brazilian women's team has had, but also the struggles that they've had, because they haven't received support from Teixeira and his clan. So can you tell us about how women's football fits in the making of the nation, or perhaps women fans?
That's a great question. And let me first talk about the, you know, women's football. I mean, which is that women's football in Brazil fits in the same way that a lot of secondary men's sports do, which is to say, when, you know, when Gustavo Kuerten, when he was, you know, doing beautifully, and when he won the French Open, tennis was a huge deal in Brazil. And when he, you know, when he went away, well, then no one really remembered. Or when a particular swimmer did really well in the Olympics, then, you know, then swimming was a huge deal. So, I mean, without getting the same kind of, you know, commitment from a government that the men's seleção gets. And I think that's very true of the women's national team too, which is that when they do well, they're doing it, you know, against obstacles set by the, you know, by the cartolas, the officials in the National Soccer Federation and the government. I mean, they get very, very little support, as you said. They happen to, you know, from time to time get enough tremendous players to you know, to really do well, and you know, players like Marta. But they're not really part of Brand Brazil. There's a little bit of it that kind of laps over onto them. You know, part of me, the truly cynical part of me, you know, thinks that, well, if the Brazilian men's team were doing better, and if there were, you know, a new Ronaldo, and, you know, if, you know, not just Neymar, then probably that space would be taken up, and the women would be even more pushed aside. So, you know, if it just functions like, you know, like a secondary men's sport. Now, women's fandom is a whole different related but different topic, and it's something that's really interesting. And there are some scholars in Brazil who are starting to do really great work on this, particularly on an earlier period, though, because, you know, Brazilian soccer has been typically defined as being a masculine domain, but there are tons and tons of women who love, who follow, who know soccer, and so they're part of this, but they are, you know, theoretically excluded from Brand Brazil.
And so it's something that I haven't figured out, and I'm waiting for colleagues elsewhere to do that for me. But I think it's fascinating. And so I have no answer except to say that's a great question, which is, you know, that's the privilege we all have as when we're teaching is to do. But I hate to do it to a colleague, but there it is. I'm doing it to you, Peter.
Well, this is why we call it an intellectual pelada.
Exactly.
Lubia.
So I know we were not doing contemporary history, but I have a question for you.
Yes.
Do you know about, what do you think about the movement Bom Senso Futebol Clube? The political organization players after the 2013 protests.
Yeah, I think it's a great development. I mean, it's very, very promising, and I understand why, you know, it's not more widespread, which is mainly that, you know, the people who are really leading it and taking the most active role in it are obviously the people who have the security to do so. And it's great that they are doing that. I think it is something that's really very, very promising in pushing reforms because, you know, we can talk about Brazil, and I'm, you know, my book ends up being about, you know, the national team almost exclusively with some, you know, discussion of mostly just the big clubs. That's a very small part of what Brazilian soccer is, and a very, very small part of the, you know, total universe of Brazilians who play soccer play at that level. I think that, you know, a movement like Bom Senso, you know, good sense, is pushing for improvements not only at big clubs, you know, pushing for things like, you know, basically a kind of unionization, but without the downside that player unionization had shown in the 70s and 80s. And I think one of the ways, you know, the movement's most promising is that it's promoting some reforms that would, you know, provide a little bit more of a kind of support network for the millions of Brazilians who, you know, who play kind of semi-professionally, who play for, you know, a minimum wage or 1.5 minimum wages per month, and even then don't get that for more than 4 or 5 months a year. So that's, you know, as you were saying earlier, you know, the national team is not that big a deal in Brazil, and it's not even that big a part of Brazilian soccer. And I think Bom Senso is you know, that's not their main focus, but I see that as being, you know, one of the areas in which they show the greatest potential for real positive change.
Thank you. We have a few minutes left. Who would like to ask the last couple of questions? Don't be shy.
Chimides now at Yanta.
I can ask.
Somebody's typing. I'm now deciphering the code. This is a little bit like our version of goal line technology. but it's not coming out properly. So, Lubia, why don't you continue since you're here and I can't decipher the code on the computer. Go for it.
Okay. As an anthropologist, I was thinking about when you were talking about the Vargas era, mm-hmm. and the comparison between football and capoeira, because when we think about Brazilian diaspora, it's related to capoeira, football, and music, samba, especially samba.
Yes.
So, do you think it's a good idea to compare the football diaspora to Capoeira diaspora, because they are very connected, because they were connected to black people in the 30s. And black people changed the football in Brazil and changed the football in the world. Brazilian black people, they came from Capoeira. And so do you think it's worth, because when someone asked a question about the globalization, the Brazilian brand, and if you go to everywhere to play, you can find a Brazilian teams without Brazilians.
Yes.
And you can find Brazilian capoeira groups without Brazilians as well.
Right. Absolutely. No, I think it's a great and really useful, really exciting comparison to be made. And I mean, part of it, there is some, chronological overlap. And you know, like when you're, it's really in the 30s that, you know, the kind of national styles are being created. And, you know, and obviously there are still very different schools of capoeira, you know, at that time and subsequently. And, you know, the different, mestres have their own, each one has his own different style and his own teachings and so on.
Because Jinga and Mandinga, that comes from capoeira, is in football as well.
Yeah, I mean, it comes from other places, but where it comes to futebol through capoeira, you're right. And
yeah.
And there's some really interesting stuff. I mean, one of the trainers, the scientific trainers I mentioned, was active in the 60s with the military. He also wrote about capoeira. This is Lamartine Pereira da Costa, and it's really interesting. And back in the 30s too, there was a lot of coverage in Rio newspapers, especially about capoeira, comparing it to other martial arts from different parts of the world, and really comparing. And a lot of it was talked, was framed in terms of modernity. Getting back to Peter's question, so there were articles about jiu-jitsu versus capoeira, and you know why capoeira is more intrinsically Brazilian, but also questioning whether it is in some ways more civilized or not. It was somewhat of an open question for journalists, many journalists of that time. But also that, even though the origins are of that kind of the solidification of a dominant style are more or less about the same time, the timing of the diaspora is really different. I mean, the diaspora of capoeira, really, really takes off later.
Yeah.
In different directions, and San Francisco becomes a really important part, place, and which it certainly isn't in terms of Brazilian futebol. So I think it's really, really interesting because there's so much overlap in terms of understandings of Afro-Brasilidade, and overlap in terms of the stereotypes about Afro-Brazilian attributes and how they fit into a national culture through these different activities, but at the same time the way they get spread and re-understood and reinterpreted in their different diasporas, I think there's also going to be some overlap, but some difference there too. So I think that's it's a great comparison to be made. Yeah.
Fabulous. We're now entering added time, and Danielle, you get the honor and privilege of asking the final question of the afternoon.
Is it about Uzo?
I was just typing when nobody asked that maybe you could conclude by saying what could you not cover in the book, but what would be interested to do in the future by you or other scholars on Brazilian football.
Well, I think Brazilian women's Futebol is something that is just it's crying out for really careful, thorough study. You know, it was supposedly officially prohibited, you know, for decades and decades, but there was at the same time, you know, I saw in the 30s and the 40s, you know, references in mainstream newspapers to, you know, women's games being played, and obviously they're getting reported. They were just being reported in a neutral kind of way. So there was clearly a whole women's game going on, and you know, that the development of that and the extent of to which it was, you know, really part of the culture of the different cities. I mean, that I think is something that really needs to be covered, and there are people working on it. I hope even more will do so. You know, and I think the kind of you know, really careful, grounded kind of work that Brenda did in her book, you know, it's the kind of thing that I'm hoping to do, you know, looking at São Paulo and looking at fan culture, and also, you know, really get at, you know, gendered identities and not just race formation, but, you know, gender formation and class formation, because, you know, now that Brenda's drilled that into my head, I'm not going to be able to escape it. But,
sorry.
No, it's really important. I'm joking, because I absolutely think it's great. It's the kind of thing that I think needs to be done, not only because, not only, you know, for the reasons we talked about, but also because, you know, for Brazilians, you know, discussions of race have always also involved discussions of class. And this is, you know, part of the whole mythology of the racial democracy. You know, when people who supported that notion would say, well, that person is, you know, where they are in society, not because of their, you know, their phenotype, but because of their class. When other people would say, well, no, obviously the fact that, you know, all these people who, you know, have access to higher education and have higher incomes are, you know, lighter skinned, that suggests it's racial discrimination. So anyway, I think even for someone who focuses mostly on race, as I have done, you know, a more central and really very concrete look at class and how that's functioned is something else that I think is, you know, absolutely necessary. So I also want to see more, you know, what I would love to see is a kind of scholarly version of what Alex Bellows does in the beginning of his book, Futebol, the Brazilian Way of Life. I may be getting the title slightly wrong. But when, you know, he does these interviews with the guys these Brazilian guys who are playing in the Faroe Islands and so on. And it's all very interesting, and it's a great story. But I really want to see, love someone to do this, and I don't think I'm going to be able to, is, you know, look at the reconstructions, reinterpretations, disputes over Brazilianness in futebol around the world, maybe South China. But also, I mean, especially in the Brazilian diaspora, and, you know, living in the Hartford, Connecticut area, you know, which is now part of the Brazilian diaspora in a pretty vigorous way, it's the kind of thing that is very interesting. And Daniel, up in Cambridge, you'll see there are a lot of Brazilians around there, too. And there are places you can go and watch games and you know, it will be like you're at a bar in Brazil watching a game. But I think the study of, you know, how futebol, you know, signifies in different places and perhaps at different periods of the Brazilian diaspora, I think would also be another really important topic.
Great. Thanks so much, Roger, and everyone I'm sure joins me in thanking you for producing such a wonderful book and sharing your time and thoughts with the group. And hopefully you'll come back for a future FSF. The next one is in October and will feature James Montague, the Indiana Jones of soccer journalism, is I think how Grant Wall of Sports Illustrated described him. We'll be reading his 31-0 book, soccer sort of on the margins, if you will. And also a reminder that in December we have an exciting roundtable on women's football, both as a practice but also as a field of study. And we'll have more details about those events as the dates draw closer. So once again, thanks, Roger, and thanks, everybody, for a great session.
Thank you all so much for putting this together, and I'm hooked. I'm in.
All right. We'll see you on the pitch soon.
Okay, great. Thank you.